opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.
All right. Well, it's Jim Newman here in bright, beautiful, sunny Brookings, Oregon for another edition of Our Veteran Community, a program that's designed to highlight the veterans that live here and make up a very important, necessary fabric of our society. A lot of these folks you live next door to, and you'd probably never, ever realize that they have served their country at one time or another in various positions, non-combat, combat, logistical support, you name it. It's all over the board. In fact, that very point really comes to fore today when we're going to be talking to my guest about her experiences in the military. And congratulations, because you are the first female veteran to actually interview on this show. So this is great. And I'm talking to Jan Hinault, who is very well known in this community for various things. Almost all of them legal, I believe. anyway, Jan, I did not know this about her. And I've known Jan, gosh, since the late 90s?
Probably around 2000.
Yeah.
Yes, and our involvement with the Humane Society in the beginning.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. The brand new building. Yeah.
Yes.
Fun stuff. Those were crazy days.
Oh, crazy days, and we made it through.
I know. We're all still living and breathing. So, yeah. Anyway, we're going to get to that eventually. But, Jan, we're going to go into the Wayback Machine and go all the way back to what town were you born in?
Oh, my goodness. I was born in a little mill town in Massachusetts. It's called Whitensville. And I was raised there. My dad was a Navy man. Mm-hmm. And so he was gone a lot. We didn't see a lot of my dad. He was a shipboard Navy. He was a boatswain's mate.
Oh, okay.
If you don't know, boatswain's mates are the people who really run the ships.
Yep. Yes. They're the ones that make things happen.
And so I was born there and raised there and set out for the Navy there. You know, a lot of people have different reasons for joining the service.
Sure.
And being from a small town like that and not really having resources for college at the time, mm-hmm. which is what I wanted to do, I decided that maybe going into the military would be a good way for me to explore the world and find a career.
Yeah, kind of a means to an end also.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that's what I did. But this was 1963.
Okay.
Back then, I was 18 years old, but I needed a parent's signature, believe it or not, to join the military. Boys who were 18 did not need that.
I know.
I know.
Yeah.
It was a different time.
Yeah.
And my father not only signed the papers, but encouraged me. Of course, it was Navy. If I had decided on a different branch, it might have been different.
Right. That's real possible.
So in September, I was on my very first airplane trip ever and flew down to Maryland, mm-hmm. Bainbridge, Maryland. That's where my boot camp training was, in Bainbridge. They've since moved the basic training, but back then it was Bainbridge, Maryland. And what I remember thinking back, you know, it's quite a while ago, but what I really remember are the classes I took, the fact that I had to stand watches in the barracks. Mm-hmm. That was the first initiation of standing watch. And then, of course, marching. Marching.
Love that.
Marching. Marching.
Marching to and fro, wherever you went.
But you know, Jim, my whole time in the service, I was always around interesting things that were happening outside the gates of the base.
Mm-hmm.
And in my boot camp, I went in September, and in November, the tragedy of my lifetime happened, and it was when John F. Kennedy was assassinated.
Right.
I remember that day, believe it or not, I was in a class, and somebody came in to tell the instructor that the president had been shot. And some of the young girls began to weep. Some sobbed.
Mm-hmm.
I think a couple of them fainted. I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
It was awful. But I was more stunned. I couldn't believe it. And it didn't really dawn on me the import of what had happened until I was sitting at my desk and I was near these windows. And I looked over my shoulder at where the flag was being flown, and they were lowering it to half staff.
Yes.
That's when it hit me.
Yeah.
Yep. And after that, it felt like the world had shifted.
Mm-hmm.
And to keep us busy, believe it or not, they marched us. We marched out on the tarmac. I can't tell you how long and how often, but for several days, because they knew we weren't going to concentrate and do what we needed to do.
Right. You needed to focus on something to take your mind off of
exactly.
the tragedy, for sure. For
That's
sure.
true. We had to, and they knew.
Right.
They knew what to right. do. So
we're not going to ignore that part of your life, but I'm going to go back to grade school.
Oh, my God, grade school.
So how big was your school?
Small. I was in a little town, and I went to a Catholic parochial school.
Oh, my condolences.
And run by nuns. So
we'll
the discipline.
Oh,
I know. The discipline has been there all my life.
Yes.
But, geez, how many kids? Oh, geez, maybe 30, 40 children.
So it was bigger than a one room schoolhouse, but
yes.
definitely not a huge elementary school.
No. And they were good years, and we got good educations. And that was it. Just elementary school. And then, of course, a lot of people. In that town, they stay in the town.
Sure.
You know, so I still have friends today from those early school days who still live
right.
there.
Right. You know, and if they don't stay, you have the phenomenon where they'll leave when they graduate from high school, but when it's time to raise a family, they come back to the
yes.
security and the more or less controlled environment of a small town for their children.
That's
because
true.
Because they have, you know, good memories.
That's true.
So did you pull any hijinks when you're in the school years K through 12?
Oh, no, I was a good kid. I would never do that.
Didn't even cross your mind?
No, not really. The boys were more into those kinds
yeah,
of things.
Yeah, well, but I know a few girls that, you know, broke curfew and snuck cigarettes and
oh,
things
no,
like that.
Oh, no, that wasn't me, but it doesn't mean I didn't have fun. But,
well, yeah.
you know, it was a rural area, and what we did, in the summer, we rode our bikes to a place called Pout Pond.
Pout Pond.
Yeah, that's what we called catfish, pout.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, back there in New England.
Never heard that before.
Yep. And yeah. we would ride our bikes to Pout Pond, take swimming lessons, play around in the pond, and go home. And to this day, when I get back there for a visit, I always go to Pout Pond, and it's still there. It's still the same.
It
Nothing
is it?
Has changed.
Wow. At least it hasn't gotten environmentally impacted
no.
by
No,
anything.
Still in the middle of farmland.
That is so idyllic. I mean, it's just amazing that you can go back and find that. You know, places I used to live, they don't exist anymore. They've either been paved over or overdeveloped or something. So it's kind of nice that there's a touchstone.
That's true. It yeah. really is. And I'm not saying a lot hasn't changed back there, but there are some things today that are almost exactly the same
wow.
as they were.
That
yeah.
is really cool. That was really yeah. cool. So what were your favorite classes in the, you know, K through 12?
Well, I liked history. I wasn't great on geography. I was okay with math,
mm-hmm.
and I liked English because I liked reading. And believe it or not, I loved sentence construction.
Oh,
remember how
diagramming
you had
sentences.
Yes.
Oh, that was the bane of my existence.
But it reminded me of math, and I would pretend I was actually doing math when I was doing it with words. But
yeah.
it was fun. It
yeah.
was fun.
I mean, it is kind of fun how you can, you know, pull a sentence apart and, you know, put all the pieces in their correct spots and know the name for everything and all that jazz, you know.
I wonder if they still do that.
You know, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think they're lucky that they can get kids to even read anymore with all the electronic devices.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, it's crazy stuff. Okay, so now we're going to get caught back up to basic training and being on base after the assassination of John F. Kennedy
right.
and marching your butts off.
Yes, we were too. And our ceremony, graduation ceremony, was probably one of the most subdued they'd ever had. But because of that, it was a very sad time.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So in 1964, I had orders to an A school, and not everybody in boot camp got A schools, but my grades were up.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to aerographer's mate.
A what?
Everybody says that.
Say who?
Aerographer.
Aerographer, okay.
Yeah, and it's a weather school. Huh. So I was, in today's vernacular, I was a weather tech.
Oh, very good.
Or learning to be.
Right.
But the interesting story, Jim, is this. Now, how did I get the school I wanted? I had worked in the small grocery store in our town with a girl named Linda.
Okay.
Linda had gone off and joined the Navy just a few months before I did. When I joined the Navy and I was in Bainbridge in boot camp, there was Linda. And she was waving to me, but recruits could not talk with staff.
It no was fraternization.
No. And she happened to be working in classification. And those are the people who assign orders and billets and things. And I remember one day I was somewhere on the base walking, and she came up to me and in passing said, "What school do you want?"
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, talk about fate.
Yeah.
And I said, AG. And sure enough, when I got my orders, I was going to AG school in Lakehurst, New Jersey.
Another classic example of it's not so much what you know, but it's who you know.
Who you know and fate. I mean, yes. Who would have thought she'd see me and all of those people?
Yeah.
It was just amazing.
Yeah.
You might know of Lakehurst. It was the base that had all the big airships back when, the Hindenburg disaster.
Yeah.
It was also home not to just the AG school, aerographer's mate school, but also parachute riggers. And I mention that because to be a parachute rigger, one of the demands was that each student had to jump from a plane with the parachute they packed.
Now, why would a sane person jump out of a perfectly good plane?
I mean, well, that's what they wanted to do.
I know.
And we always knew when those flights took place because that night in the chow hall, we would see people limping and people on crutches and bandage.
Bad landing, so, huh?
Bad landing. Well, they weren't really jumpers. They were parachute riggers. But it was kind of neat to see.
Oh, wow. So your weather duties, did that have an effect on, you know, when certain activities happened? If you had, like, bad fronts coming in, the parachuters couldn't go up and do their thing? Or
oh, I'm sure that is true. It's like anything. You know, everything runs on weather. And it's gotten better and better mm-hmm. as years have gone by. But as you know, the weather makes it happen or not, whatever it is. I mean, World War II and
the invasion of Normandy and all that kind of stuff. Man, that was crazy trying to prognosticate.
They had the weather, the cloud coverage, but they didn't have the oceans.
Right.
And that was a thing even back then. I'm talking 1964 when I went to school. And even through my career, my 7 years of Navy, there was never a true understanding of the effect of ocean on weather and mm-hmm. and air on the ocean. And so it was an interesting time. So you had your oceanography division and you had your meteorology division.
Right,
so
right.
That's all changed, of course.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it's amazing all the advances that have been made in the last, you know, 40 years as far as that goes. And now the military is looking at controlling the weather as a form of warfare.
Yes, and isn't that a sad note?
It's scary as hell.
And now we're going into space. We have our space force. And
yeah.
I wonder if they need weathermen up there.
Hmm.
Oh, that would be interesting.
So you were in basic and in your advanced training in 64. Still a pretty much chauvinistic, male, patriarchal society, and the military is like that on steroids. So what was your experience? What, I mean, did you get hit upside the head right away? And
well, I got hit on, but not upside the head. No, my experiences were generally, except for one particular area, and I'd like to get into that in a little bit, one particular duty station. My experiences were pretty good. I think I got along well with most of the guys mm-hmm. I was stationed with. And women were still such a minority. I mean, in my class of maybe 30, 40 sailors, there were probably two. I think there were two of us,
wow.
two females. And that's true wherever you went in the Navy. You were always the female. And one of two things could happen. You could fit in.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be one of the guys. You just have to show you need respect, and you respect the guys.
Right.
Or you didn't, and you were, you know, something else and having a hard time.
Right.
Generally speaking, my entire Navy years were pretty good.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
I made a lot of good friends, had a lot of fun.
Yeah. So basic training for you, was that the typical 8-week course?
I think it was a 10-week thing. Then my training, my school was probably 16 weeks. They've cut that way down now. And I don't even know that the Navy has aerographer's mate school. I think they join it with the Air Force now.
Okay.
I could be wrong about that, but or maybe the Air Force comes to the Navy school. But after the school, I went to my first duty station, and that was Jacksonville, Florida.
Ooh.
And now I'm talking 64, 66.
Ooh.
And Jim, you have a good sense of history. 64, 66, the civil rights movement. I'm trying to fill in what was happening around me while I was in this nice little cocoon of being on base and in the Navy. But what I'd like to talk about first is when I got to the base and I had finished my schooling. This is in the days before computers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think people realize how things worked before computers.
Yeah, well, the world did exist before computers.
Yes. And we had information come in over teletypes. And teletypes were interesting themselves because they weren't machines you typed on. They were machines you hit keys and made yellow strips with punch holes in them.
Right.
For the messages you were sending out. So when we took our weather observations, we'd put our weather report, and then we'd feed it through this little thing, and it would read out and go to teletypes all over the world. And that's how we got our weather reports. Teletypes were very noisy.
Mm-hmm.
They were in usually soundproof rooms, so you couldn't hear it outside the room. So running in there to tear teletype printouts so that you had the information, you needed to plot a map. We hand-plotted maps. I mean, I'm talking hundreds and hundreds of plots on a surface chart all over the United States, and ships that were reporting in. The government used to make contracts with ships from all over the world to get weather reports in so they knew what was happening out in the ocean. I mean, there were no satellites, nothing.
No,
that's how they got their reports.
It's like, you know, visuals via teletype, basically. Mm.
So we had to plot all the data around the stations, and so we had kind of remembered the call letters of everything from New England down to Southern California and the other way, northwest to the southeast, and everything in between. So here we were madly plotting because it had to be done in a certain time. And you're talking wind direction and speed, pressure, temperature, what weather there was. I mean, there were all these symbols and codes you had to remember. And everything for one station had to fit under a dime. And then when you finally finished plotting that map, the forecaster would come, and he would, or she, would actually draw in the isobars and the front lines and the highs and the lows and all of that. And then they'd analyze the weather, and that was, for the surface, the basic thing they would use to forecast. We also did upper air charts the same way. So there was this manual plotting of charts. And it took a while to do them, and it was a lot of work. It was fun, but it was hard.
As compared to today, I've got an app on my phone, AccuWeather, from one of the stations over in the valley. I can type in the name of any city in the world and get instantaneously, reporting on what the weather's like. It's just incredible.
Well, for us, we had to wait till the report came in over the teletype.
Yep. High degree of patience involved.
The other interesting thing in Jacksonville that really stays with me is the weather office had a very close relationship with the hurricane hunters who were, it was VW4, and they were stationed at Jacksonville. And these guys were something.
Oh,
they'd
I
come
bet.
In. Not only were they good looking, it seemed like, in their flight suits. But they would come into the office, and they read everything. They wanted the upper air charts. They wanted to know. And then when they were in the air, they would be sending back information, too.
Mm-hmm.
So working with the hurricane hunters was a lot of fun.
Yeah,
and serious work.
Yeah.
being in Jacksonville, again, like I say, I was in this cocoon because I was working hard and I wanted to be a good mm-hmm. weather person. But outside the gates, a lot was happening sure. with civil rights. This is the South, 1964-66.
Right.
And there were a lot of protests and for civil rights. And looking back now, I wish I had been more aware mm-hmm. of what was going on around me, because I didn't quite understand the whole thing. But I do have to tell you the shocking thing when I finally did make it to Jacksonville after coming from the north. I walked into the bus depot. I had to catch a bus to my duty station. And it was segregated.
Yeah.
There were seatings for blacks and whites on the counter, and it actually said it. There were two fountains side by side. One said blacks, one said whites.
Bathrooms. Yeah.
And it shocked me.
Yeah.
And even though I was shocked and mad, really, in a way, still, when I saw the protests on TV, I couldn't really get into that. I didn't understand the bravery and the sacrifices of some of these people.
Mm-hmm.
But it had really little to do with me at the time because I was so involved with my job.
Right, right. Yeah, but it is, like you say, interesting to kind of bookcase the real world versus what you,
yes.
know, you were definitely involved in, to give a context of the things that we've basically experienced, lived through, you know, and can talk about.
That's true.
You know, everybody's like a walking book of history.
That's right.
Given wherever you were in your life at the time. And it's all different perspectives, and that's what makes it so enjoyable to talk to people, at least on my part, you know, because I get to know people like we're doing today.
Yes.
You know, I get to do it with my carpet cleaning business in their own home.
Yes.
You know, and I'll see pictures and I'll go, well, what's that about? You know, and yeah, so it's really cool.
No.
So, okay, so Jacksonville, Florida.
And then my next duty station in 66 was at the weather office in Barbers Point, Oahu, Hawaii.
Oh, nice.
Oh, that was
Hawaii 5-0.
Because my initial enlistment in the Navy was for 3 years. Women could not sign up for more than 3 years. They thought we'd leave. They thought we'd get married. They thought whatever they thought. So in order to get my orders to Hawaii, I extended my enlistment for 4 years, and I did get those orders. I got to say, as an AG, the basic job didn't change. I was still plotting charts, still tearing teletypes, still filing, still helping the forecaster. I was swabbing decks. I was doing everything you had to do as an enlisted. And when I arrived, I remember at the barracks, some of the waves came up to me and said, pick out a cane field that they just planted. Pick it out, and that'll be your cane field. Because when that cane field has grown up and is harvested, it will be 2 years. And your tour is 2 years, and it'll be the way you keep track of how long you've been here.
Interesting. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So while I was there, of course, the Vietnam War was pretty intense.
Yeah.
This is 1968. And I think we were close to the war as you could be without being in the war,
right.
being in Hawaii. And I say that because ships would come up to Pearl and unload, these men who had been wounded. You'd see them in wheelchairs or on gurneys or walking with crutches, looking mm-hmm. forlorn and hurt, and they'd be going over to the Army hospital.
Right.
And there were times that having seen this and also seeing the transients that would come through Hawaii. And what I mean by transients, these were young men, sailors, Marines, who would have a layover in Barbers Point. And there was a transient barracks right across from the waves quarters, mm-hmm. of all places to put it, poor guys. And they were on their way to Vietnam.
Yeah.
And sometimes even the base itself would be almost swept clean of sailors to be sent. So these guys were in Hawaii thinking, I've got this duty station, I'm not going to Nam. But then they'd get orders. Mm. And I am not kidding when I say sweep the base. And I think there was a lot of anger in some of these young men, and they aimed it sometimes toward the women who were enlisted because they had to go to Nam.
Right.
But the women never left.
Right.
The women stayed. And it's for this reason, I think, that in my entire career, I faced the most severe and intense and continuous sexual harassment of any place.
Yeah.
Inside the weather office as well as outside. And if it hadn't been for this group of waves, we were called waves then. If it hadn't been for these friends that I made and have become lifetime friends, and I think that's why the bonding there was so strong. We were protecting each other.
Right.
I don't know how many of us would have really been able to get through that time.
Yeah.
There was nobody to report sexual harassment to.
No.
If you went to your wave rep, she was an officer looking out for her own career. She didn't want to really stir up.
She didn't want to make any waves.
No,
literally.
Don't rock the boat, so to speak.
No.
If you went to your senior petty officer or officer, they would say things like, it's your choice to be here. You wanted to join the boys' club?
That's right.
Just
suck it
deal
up.
With it. Suck it up. Yeah.
Yep.
So it was a tough time.
Yeah.
But we got through it. One day, I noticed my cane field had grown up. And I said at that time, so had I grown up.
Yippee!
And it was time to leave Hawaii. Although I loved Hawaii, it was time to leave. And that brings me to 68 to 70. My duty orders then went to Alameda, California.
Okay.
So my initial orders were for Monterey, the Naval Officers School down there.
Yeah, kind of a cushy little thing.
Yes, a nice little weather office. And but then the orders changed, and I was sent to Alameda, which made all the difference in my life, of course. While in Alameda, it was such a welcoming place. I mean, it was so different from my experience in Hawaii. That it was like two worlds. And I was assigned to the climatology desk for a while, and that was really fun, doing climatology, records of history, and keeping track of weather as it occurred and as it had occurred. But you know what, Jim? It was at that time computers started raising their little heads. And I was really presented great opportunities. I was one of the first people to work with weather computers. But don't think the computers are anything like today. They were giant tape decks.
Oh, I know.
Huge things. And there was a row of three or four of them with tapes that were probably 2 feet across.
Yep.
Would you say that's a diameter of two
feet?
Yeah. The control panel was the size of a desk, and it had 10 little lights on it that you would punch for codes, depending what you wanted to do. Okay, so how did this work? We got signals from Monterey to plot charts on machine. And these plotters were so, so new, beginning, baby steps, right? The chart paper was on a drum that would go up and down, around. And the pen to plot, they actually plotted with a pen. That gave you all kinds of headaches because sometimes it would clog up or leak. Or and the pen would just go left to right. So if you can picture this, the drum up and down, the pen left and right, and it's plotting on these electrical signals. And the end result was something like a chart. I mean, the lines
were
almost like isobars, except they were square. A lot of 90-degree angles on these charts. But after you looked at them, I mean, but it was the beginning.
That's crazy. We're going to take a little bit of a break for our station ID, and we'll get back to the rudimentary early days of computers in the Navy. This is Jim Newman, and you are listening to KCIW LP. Curry Coast Community Radio, 100.7 FM on your radio dial. You'll also be able to tune in the podcast. You can access that by going to Curry Coast Community Radio, kciw.org, and they have a link for podcasts, and you can see all the various interesting podcasts that the station has done over the last 3 years, 4 years. I don't know how long it's been, a long time. At any rate, we're going to get back to talking to Jan, who is now in Alameda, dealing with the first generation of crazy computers. Now, I'll get a little aside here. I went out to Cal Poly Pomona, and I was taking industrial engineering. And one of my classes was computers. Well, I remember carrying the boxes of cards around, the punch cards.
Yeah,
one day I stumbled, tripped, and the box went everywhere. And oh my gosh, it was hours to get everything in the right order. So yeah, that's a little personal thing for me regarding early computers. Okay, so back to the ISO bars, the ink, the huge computers, and all that stuff. So what's going on?
Okay, so it was also the time when satellite pictures were just coming in.
Hmm.
Now, you're not going to believe this, but there was an antenna on top of the weather building, which was also where the air traffic control tower was. It was always one building, where whatever base you went to. And there, this antenna looked like something out of Buck Rogers. I'm not kidding. It was so amazing. It looked like some kind of ray gun. And it was controlled with this machine in the weather office. You had toggle switch on either side. And you had to know exactly the time the satellite was coming over.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd toggle with this chart you had to try to make sure that antenna was staying right on that.
Was tracking, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And then when you finally, it was fun though, when you finally got the signal in and the chart was plotting, again, it was a drum or a cylinder that went around, but this time it had a helix wire that went across. And what that helix wire did is it would burn electrical impressions into some treated paper.
Mm-hmm.
The chart came out fuzzy. It was purplish in color. I could never find the coast of California on that thing. And everybody's going, wow, yeah, look at that cloud. Look at that cloud. And I'm thinking, I don't see clouds. I don't know what they're seeing. But what it was wonderful about that is it felt like the future was here.
Yeah.
We were seeing what was going to be coming.
Right.
Nobody imagined what we have now, but we could see something new was happening. So that was really a lot of fun, too. Now, what was happening outside the gates, again, this is 68, 69, 70.
Summer of Love, San Francisco, Haight-Ashbury.
We used to go make trips over there and just look at all the hippies. We loved looking at the hippies.
Did you feel superior to the hippies?
No, I think
or
we wanted
envious.
We wanted to be hippies, some of us.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
We couldn't, though, of course. But outside the gates were the beginnings of the protest against the Vietnam War.
Right.
And a lot of us, you know, would have discussions and almost like today, they would turn in sometimes angrily. They turn anger against each other, mainly because some were so for the war. I don't know that they were for the war. I think they were more for the people who fought the wars. In other words, the people over there dying and being hurt. Nobody understood why we were there. You'd say, why are we there? And they'd say, you know, we're protecting America. Well,
the domino effect.
Yes. No, it's true. So there were some pretty intense conversations.
I bet.
But at the same time, it was quite an awakening that not everybody in the world thought like we thought.
Yeah.
Or cared to do the things we did.
Mm-hmm.
And patriotism comes in all kinds of shades and sizes and shapes. It's not one thing.
No, it's not.
So that was the big awakening in my life there.
Well,
anyway,
and, you know, it was also a time of sexual liberation, redefining roles of men and women in society. I mean, all this stuff is thrown together in this huge, giant cement mixer called civilization.
It was just an amazing time.
Yeah.
People don't quite, unless you were there. And even now, I was there, and I'm going like, boy, I can't believe I was really there when, you know. Of course, it was years later, not when I was in the military, but I was, you know, working for the Navy after I got out of the service. But the point is, there was so much happening. and the world was changing so fast.
Yeah.
And it's almost like you'd have to try to catch your breath.
Yeah, that was the first war that you could watch on TV while you're having dinner.
They don't do that anymore, do they?
And it was. I remember sitting, you know, watching dinner and seeing the you know, statistics on how many soldiers were killed that day. And it's just like surreal.
Yes.
You know, and I was still in high school back then. You know, I'm just going, whoa, this is weird.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you guys went off base, when you gals went off base.
Mm-hmm. We're guys, girl.
Yeah. Okay. did you wear your civvies or were you in uniform?
Oh, no. We always wore civvies. In fact, when I was in Hawaii, I was known as the Vespa riding jam wearing wave. We had to wear helmets on base, and as soon as I got through the gate, the helmet came off and went riding down to Waikiki on my little red Vespa that we had cool. painted Jelly Bean Cooter on the side. And I tell you, I had a great time. Even in Hawaii, you know, mm-hmm. it was a lot of fun. But, it was civvies 100% of the time once you're out the gate.
Now, being a musician in San Francisco and that area, having so many great clubs with all sorts of different kinds of music, did you guys avail yourself of the music scene?
Unfortunately, not in San Francisco, but we did go to lots of little local shows and things. A lot of my friends weren't quite into all of that stuff.
Okay.
So I didn't get to see people like Janis Joplin when she came, or, you know, people like that. But
right. But
Lydia Pence, if you were in San Francisco, you might remember what were they called?
Cold Blood.
Cold Blood.
Well, guess what? Lydia's coming back to town in August.
Really?
I'm in communication with a real good friend, and she wants to play up at the Grange when she comes back.
Oh, I was a big fan of Lydia Pence. Yeah, well, she was the Janis Joplin of San Francisco.
Well, she's coming back, so it'll be like a flashback for you.
Oh, it will.
Yeah, fun stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there was just a lot of great music going on there.
Oh, there was wonderful. Yeah.
I think looking at music historically, I think the period of time from the mid-60s through most of the 70s was kind of like the heyday, the golden years of music creation.
Creation, exactly.
You know, yeah, because there was all different kinds, and there was political statements, and there was social consciousness, and all sorts of different things, and just goofy, silly, you know, music and stuff like that. Yeah. So, but neat stuff. So,
yes, but it's 1970, and I leave the Navy, and now I'm out in the world.
Now what, right? Mm.
So, one of the things that I did, and one of the reasons I think initially, although I never said the words, of joining the military was to have an opportunity to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
And so as soon as I walked out the gates, and I was really a civilian, although I did stay in the reserves for many years afterwards, I got the GI Bill and I went to school. First 2 years were in a community college, and my grades were good. And I always took the hardest teachers. This is a lesson for young people. If you want to really succeed, don't take the easy teachers in college. Take the hard ones. Yeah. Be challenged. And I got accepted into Cal Berkeley.
Nice.
And I got my degree from Cal Berkeley.
Of course, you know that we call it Berserkly, but
yeah. Yeah, well, I did too at the time. It's a crazy, great, great place.
Yeah.
And you talk about craziness. I mean, I was going to school when Patty Hearst was kidnapped.
Holy moly.
There was the People's Park, all of that happening. Black Panthers were coming up in Oakland. Amazing political things were happening. Mm-hmm. And I had this great background behind me. Navy and discipline and not flying off the handle, so to speak, and getting all swept up, although there were things that I certainly strongly believed in.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it was just an amazing, amazing place to be at that time. So after my degree at Cal, which I loved, I thought I was going to go into oceanography, by the way.
Oh, okay.
But then I met this philosopher. She was, I guess her family had escaped from Germany when she was tiny. And
so she's basically a Holocaust survivor?
I wouldn't say a survivor of the Holocaust, but I think her family got out.
Yeah.
And she was a visiting professor from New York. and took one class, and that was it. My whole life changed. Mm-hmm. I took a right-hand turn, or maybe a left-hand turn.
Yeah, well.
And became a real proponent of philosophers like Hume, and I can't name them all, but I could see the importance of critical theory, not just critical thinking, but critical theory. Mm-hmm. And then, even today, people say, well, what did you do with your college education? And I say, I learned to live my life. I learned to appreciate my world. Mm-hmm. And that really is what it was about. There were other things happening out there
right.
that I had no clue.
Right.
So after I graduated, I thought I was going to spend the whole summer on the beach in Alameda. Just finally, I'm going to lay back.
Beautiful dreamer.
And I said, I'm going to go take the civil service test and just see what happens. I'll never get a call. It's the civil service test. It's right. going to take forever. 2 weeks later, I get a call. I was like one of the top three people in the test. And that was funny because I was getting all these job offers, FBI in San Francisco.
Wow.
I went for an interview, and I didn't like the guy. He was like too, I don't know what.
Too stick up the butt.
Well, maybe. But he had asked me, you'll be going into the NARC squad. And he said, do you think you could arrest mom and pop who's selling a little bit of out of their store of marijuana to make ends meet? And that was the question I couldn't answer. I said, well, if they're my mom and pop, I don't know. But no, I didn't say that. So that was next. And there were a couple other things, that were offered to me. And then I get a call from the Navy base at Alameda. And that's the job I took.
Okay.
And after I took that job, not long after, I got accepted into an apprenticeship program in avionics. It was a 4-year apprenticeship. And I became then an aircraft instrument mechanic journeyman after 4 years. Well, it took more time to get your journeyman, but so I learned all about how to repair aircraft instruments.
Okay.
So all kinds of instruments.
You're kind of like a private contractor at that time?
No, I'm working for the Navy. We had our own depot, repair depot. They repaired aircraft engines. They did the guidance systems for missiles. We did aircraft painting on the base. We did engineering. There was even a specialized place where they tested a particular gun off of an aircraft because it was all computerized finally, but the sand that they used came up from Monterey. It had to be a specific sand.
Interesting.
And so I worked on instruments like aircraft speed indicators, altitude indicators. They were mechanical and electrical.
Mm-hmm.
Again, there was no computer anything yet on these instruments. And navigation systems were actually a platform with 3 different gyros.
Okay.
Now picture azimuth, pitch,
mm-hmm.
and direction. So because of that, you had to really know how to work gyros and wiring.
And the calibration.
And all the whole thing.
Wow.
So it was a lot of fun. But the best thing about that job, although I did stay on the, what we call staying on the bench a while and actually did a lot of instruments, it opened the door for me for other jobs. Jim, I'm a kind of person that I like to experience lots of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided that maybe I should try to be an aircraft instrument mechanic instructor and teach other apprentices. And I did get that job. And then from there, I went into technical training. And then from that, I got kind of bogged down with technical training. And then because it was the same thing, you're setting up respirator training, forklift training, blah, blah, blah. I was just right. setting up schedules. I wasn't really like doing the training.
Right.
And then became an industrial specialist where I worked on a program with the budget people planning a multi-million-dollar program that did all kinds of these different aspects that had to be done, like salvage of ships or training of summer students, and I can't even remember all of them. There were something like 10 different programs.
Wow.
And then from there, after I felt like I had gone as far as I needed to go, I decided to put in for contract specialist. And my boss, when I was an industrial specialist, said, "Why do you want to go? Why do you want to go? You're at the top of your field right now. You're doing everything right." And I said, "Because I'm at the top of the field, and unless you move out, I can't get your job."
Yeah.
So I went into contract specialist, and very interesting. That's the Navy doing contracts with civilian companies. And the biggest part of my job was helping people to write proposals to go out for bid. Mm. So we called them RFPs, requests for proposal. So we would write the RFPs and then get the proposals back, and somebody else would make the judgment on what company got it, but usually went to the low bid.
Mm-hmm.
Not always the best.
Right.
And then my final job with the Navy was with the business office. There were these smart young people who thought that we should prove we can compete with people like Boeing to get the jobs, because it was a huge repair depot. We did the P-3s and A-6s, I think, with the aircraft we did.
Mm-hmm.
And no training. They just said, "Okay, you're going to be a project leader, and you're going to write contracts competing with Boeing, whose
what?
Contract specialists made probably $100,000 a year." And yeah. By then, I was a GS-12, and I felt confident we could do it, and I was a fairly good writer. And being a project manager was fun because we pulled everybody from all over, the engineering people, the planning people, the safety people, you name it. We pulled them all together to write sections of the proposal, and then I would put it all together.
I mean, in the darkest moments of the night, did you ever go, "What in the heck am I doing?"
All the time. It was stressful.
Yeah.
It was stressful. I'd wake up at night and say, "Oh my God, how am I going to get through that? How am I going to make those? How is that going to happen?" But you work through it.
Yeah.
Nothing's perfect.
Well, and it helps to have a great staff to work with.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly. It's not one person.
That's right.
That's right. And then finally, what happened in the business office is, if you remember back in the 90s, they began closing bases all over the United States.
Base restructuring.
Yes, and Alameda was on the list. And I think even though we had a brand new state-of-the-art aircraft painting building, we had a brand new engineering building, we had a guidance system building that these guidance systems have to be isolated. You can't just put them anywhere and make them. They have to be out of magnetic fields, electrical fields, everything has to, anyway. You get the idea. We had all this great new building, millions and millions of dollars in that base, and they chopped it.
Well, we all know that government and common sense do not occupy the same place at the same time.
Well, and that's possibly true. I think two things happened to Alameda, to put it where it was. One, we had just not long before that suffered a massive earthquake.
Yes.
And even the runway had dropped something like 5 inches.
Wow.
And some of the hangars, the floors had dropped, and the buildings were crooked. And we kept getting this liquefaction.
Yes.
You know, Alameda is mostly on landfill.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'd walk around the base and you'd see these things that looked like giant anthills, and you knew it was the dirt coming up. It was the sand that had liquefied.
Mm.
So number one, just the repair work on that would have been millions, and then again, it could happen any time again.
Exactly.
So that was number one. And number two was the vulnerability to political activists, because Alameda, there were only three roads in.
Right.
A bridge, a back road from the airport area, and the tunnel. And the political activists, the anti-war people, would block those.
Sure.
In the morning. So people trying to get to work, they couldn't get to work. I think that was one of the things, too.
Mm-hmm.
Dianne Feinstein was a big supporter of the Navy, and that's when Fleet Week came in and everything, but she couldn't save us.
No.
And so
Yeah.
That's what I thought
happened. Yeah, interesting.
So I worked until the base closed, and I retired with 26 years combined military and federal service.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is that when you decided to start looking for someplace different to live?
Absolutely. I knew I wanted to be near the ocean and discovered Brookings.
Yeah.
Of course, it took me about 10 years to get here, but
it's a work in progress.
But yeah. And not just a new place to be, but new things to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I were very involved with the Humane Society here back in its early days.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I was on the board when we were building the building.
Yes.
And writing the policies. We wrote policies. Nothing like this had been done. It was something I'd never done.
Right.
There's no school that says, this is how you do it.
Right.
This is how you build a shelter. This is how you run a shelter. Yeah, we made it through.
Yeah, we did. You know, and there were some, you know, eeky squeaky moments. Some very interesting board meetings.
Yes, and I remember when we didn't know if we'd have enough money, you know, just for the food for the animals the next month. And,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Crazy, crazy stuff. Yeah. So, and that was 2000, right around there.
Yep, 2000, 2003.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. So since then, what have you been up to?
Well,
that's only 17 years to cover, you know.
Walking the beaches, walking the trails. Let's see, I was involved with Friends of Music. I was a weather spotter for NOAA. I don't do that much anymore. Anyway, I was a weather spotter. I worked in my homeowners organization and pretty much whatever came up. And I did a lot of volunteer work with the Humane Society.
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah.
It took a lot of time with me.
Yeah, kind of like more behind the scenes rather than
That's right.
Yeah, the board level and stuff like that. So, yeah, they've got a good group there now. You know, I think they're headed in a very strong direction. I went over to Superfly last week and did the Mutts and Martinis. That was a great idea. I mean, just like how clever to connect those two, you know?
Yeah.
So that was neat. Anyway, so what originally attracted you to Brookings?
Well, I was looking to be on the ocean or near the ocean. And when I came through Brookings the first time, I wasn't too impressed, to tell you the truth, coming down the main road. I said, oh, it's a funky little town. There's nothing here. But
exactly.
Then I got north of town and came down that hill at Harris Beach.
Yeah.
And I went, oh my God, I got to live here.
Right.
And then I discovered Lone Ranch.
Uh-huh.
And then some of the trails in the woods and, and the rivers. What's not to love here?
Right.
You've got whatever it is you want.
You know, in a stark contrast from the congestion and the just multitude of peoples from where you spent a lot of years.
No.
It's nice to get into a slower pace, you know, more laid back. You know, beautiful scenery. So something that feeds one's soul on
a
daily basis.
It, exactly.
Yeah.
That was it. In fact, now if I have to wait 3 minutes to make a left-hand turn off Checo Ave, I get upset.
Yeah.
Where are all these people coming from? There's like five cars, right?
I know, it's crazy. You know, it's like having lived in Los Angeles, 60-minute commutes were no big deal. So Brookings has got a lot of really good things going for it, but what are some of the things that you'd like to see changed?
I'd like to see more progressive politics in the area.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see people first. Not, I don't know if that makes sense to you, but I would like to see, I don't know, I'd like to see a Sonic come in town.
A Sonic?
Or a Popeyes, one of the two.
All right. The way to a woman's heart is through her stomach.
I don't know. You know, there are some things, but for what it is, I think Brookings is a wonderful place.
Mm-hmm.
I think most of the people are good people. I don't like when I read a letter to the editor and they call the homeless people bums. I wish they wouldn't do that. Their people.
Yeah, there's got to be a happy medium between derogatory terms and politically correct terminology.
Yeah, find that middle place where, you know, you can compromise.
Right, and being, you know, on the food bank board, I talk with our executive director about that all the time, and it is an issue. Almost all cities are going to have to deal with it eventually. So those are that's one of the big challenges for sure.
Have to figure it out.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's a great tradition of people begging. Mm-hmm. It goes back thousands. Oh, yeah. I mean, you can look at the roots of Christianity. You can look at Buddhist monks. You can look at, I mean, there's this huge tradition mm-hmm. You know, not discarding those people who are asking right. for things.
Even musicians who busk, you know, they
there
open their
go.
Guitar case, you know, and you throw money in.
That's
it's a form of begging. They are giving something, you know, back in essence, you know, music for the soul and all that kind of stuff. But it's still a form, and I don't think it's a bad thing. You know, mm-hmm. it makes people uncomfortable to realize that there are folks out there that need help and that are worse off than we are.
I would agree. And I think just because one person makes it, you mm-hmm. know, becomes financially safe and sound and can afford things, doesn't mean that everybody can do that.
Right.
There's all kinds of reasons why.
Right.
You know? So, yeah, I agree.
Well, this has been a very fast hour. I think
it
you'd
has.
Have to agree.
I'm glad I came with a few notes for my...
Well, yeah, it triggers the Wayback Machine and
yes.
the two brain cells that are left bouncing around up there. I have the same problem. So, Jan, I really appreciate your spending the time in the studio with us, and I have gotten to know you so much better just from this hour.
I know. I'm going to have to interview you now, Jim.
Hey, how about that? I was just interviewed by Jim Grangene on The Music Show and talking about my music persona, basically, and
yeah.
all that kind of stuff. So that would be fun. I would enjoy an opportunity.
Well, I'll listen to the interview.
I think you'll be very impressed with the job that Gene does here on the editing. And I've gotten actually a couple of letters of thank yous from my interviewees. And it's really nice to see that a show like this can make a difference on a personal level with some of these veterans. So,
mm-hmm.
Okay, until we see each other on the street passing in cars or in the aisle of the local supermarket. Yeah, I wish you a great, beautiful, sunny day out there.
Well, thank you, Jim. Same to you.
Take care. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Folks, this has been another episode of Our Veteran Community. If you like what you're hearing, we're always looking for volunteers at the studio level. There's lots of different opportunities for people to get involved. Go to kciw.org. There's links for volunteering, program suggestions, podcast schedules, the regular radio schedules. I mean, it's all there at kciw.org. Until next time, Jim Newman with Our Veteran Community.
The opinions expressed here were those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in the program.